From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made about a year ago when the Office of the Inspector General reported that roughly a third of children in foster care were not getting their well-child checkups on time. Reporter Michelle Faust covered the story for WXXI News, but she saw a need to delve deeper into the challenges faced by children in foster care. At the core of this issue is trauma. Kids in foster care deal with trauma almost by definition. The very act of leaving their original home is traumatizing. So WXXI News is presenting a series of reports called Fragile Lives, examining the health outcomes of children in foster care. The series running all month long. You might have heard some of the stories in recent days. And this hour, an extended conversation about foster care. I'll start by welcoming Michelle Faust from right down the hall in the newsroom. Thanks for helping put this together. Nice work already on this series, and nice to see you in studio again.
Thank you very much.
Also in studio with us is Amy Realbuto, who is a nurse practitioner at Starlight Pediatric. Amy, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Liz Koikendahl is here, and Liz is an administrative assistant at Steelwork in Rochester and a former foster kid. Liz, nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Also here is Damon Bradford, a SUNY Brockport senior and also a product of the foster care system. Nice to see you as well, Damon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
All right, Michelle Faust, for you, we go back a year ago, and, you know, we cover a lot of stories in a year. But there are moments where I think you and I and anybody who works in journalism where you say, I have to find a way to tell more of these stories, or this needs more telling. Why did this grab you in particular?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that, Evan. And I'll disclose, you know, the one thing. I was not ever in foster care myself, but I am adopted. And it is something that I've been thinking about my whole life. Next door to us, there was a home that fostered, and there was always kids, my playmates, that were walking with me to school, and they were all in foster care. So it was something that was kind of in the back of my mind from infancy, from being very young. And then when I was a reporter in Southern Arizona, there was a terrible crisis in the state of Arizona, and the kids in the child welfare system at alarming numbers, and I don't have those numbers right in front of me, but, you know, inching up to 200 kids in a year that would die. There was some sort of intervention in their homes, and whether they were put in a foster care home or left in their original homes, these kids were dying from abuse or neglect. And I felt like as a reporter, I needed to get involved and do something and tell the stories of these kids, because all you would hear was a number. And as you know, Evan, when I tell stories, I want to tell stories of real people and not so many just numbers. What is behind the numbers? So I had that interest, and then, like you mentioned, about a year ago, there was that coming from the Office of Inspector General showing that many, many kids were not getting the treatment that they needed for their health care. And as a health reporter, I said, we need to look into that a little bit more. Now, when I did that story, it came to my attention that there was a clinic in this area here in Rochester serving all the kids in foster care in Monroe County called Starlight Pediatric. And Starlight was a model for the country of a way to have a health home that addresses this issue, that makes sure that these kids are actually getting the well-child checkups that they're supposed to be getting, and is also paying attention to their increased health needs. And I think at this point we probably should have Amy Realbuto. You are a nurse practitioner, pretty much, you know, running the show over there, and you get a lot of kudos from the people that I've spoken to. Could you give us an idea of the philosophy behind what is Starlight?
Well, as you already mentioned, the philosophy behind Starlight is truly a medical home for children in foster care. Part of the reason that this clinic was started so many years ago was just that these children were not receiving the medical care in a timely fashion. Their needs weren't addressed in a way that they needed to be. So this clinic came about because of that. And it's been about 25, 30 years, and since then we've grown from that. And, you know, we see these children, we see them quick, we see them often, and our care is trauma-informed.
And let me ask, you know, Michelle mentioned that this Inspector General report found that a good number of kids are not getting well-child checkups and the health care that they should be getting. You know, how do we define what that is, what kids should be getting?
Well, The national standard for children in foster care is once they have come in to foster care, they need to be seen within 72 hours by a medical professional. And we try very hard to follow that. And I think we do a really good job at Starlight with seeing them within those 72 hours. Some of those outliers, we make that determination case by case. So I think it's very difficult sometimes. We're a smaller clinic. On any given day, we have about 500 children in foster care. Then those are more current numbers. So you've got to understand that we're a little bit smaller. We have that availability. How we are structured, how we are set up is to allow for certain slots for these kids that come in, because we can't predict. We could have weeks where we don't see any children. We have weeks where we have 10 or 11 kids that come in, and we've got to fit all those children in. So we are set up in a way that we are able to do that. Other pediatric offices are a bit higher volume and find it a little bit more difficult to see them as quickly and as often. So that's sort of the difference between Starlight and potentially a pediatric office out in our community.
And can we just kind of get a numerical sketch? And listen, I agree with Michelle Faust 100%. We're not just talking stats and numbers. I mean, that's what we're going to be talking about, Damon and Liz's stories and understanding the real human impacts here. But I do want to understand just how common foster care is in this country and maybe where it is locally. So can you give me a sense for that, Amy?
Well, last year alone, we had about 1,900 visits. But you have to remember that these are kids that are being seen very quickly. We're seeing them again within a month. Mm-hmm. We're seeing them again within 2 months. And then we're seeing them every 6 months.
All right, so forgive me, 1,900 last year, that's new kids in foster care just locally, or is that?
That's just the visits that we
just
saw last year. I don't have the exact number as far as new kids placed into care.
Okay. But Michelle, nationwide, I mean, just looking at some of the stats you've compiled.
Yeah, that's right.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, so we've got about 650,000 kids. The latest stats that were released were from 2014. 650,000 kids in foster care at some point in the year, but it stays about steady at about 400,000. And that kind of stays steady over the last 10 years. There's been some decline, actually not over the last 4 years, over the last 5 years. But in the last 15 years, there's been a steady decline in the number of kids. You just see that line just going down, down, down. And because it was many, many more. But there's been a slight uptick nationwide, and that's related to the opioid epidemic and the addiction epidemic in this country. So parents being touched by addiction, and that has an effect on the kids. And that's another way that I was brought into this after doing a lot of reporting on addiction.
All right, sure. Well, I want to hear the stories of some of our guests in studio, but I'd like Michelle to make sure our listeners know where your work all month long is with Fragile Lives here. You can already find some work on WXXINews.org. But why don't you tell us?
Yeah, you can find the first story on WXXINews.org. There's a little button on the side that says Fragile Lives. You click on that, and you'll be taken to the work. And as things are updated, it'll be going on there. Also, it's on Morning Edition and All Things Considered in the morning and the afternoon, both Mondays and Wednesdays. We've got some interviews that are kind of longer-form interviews, and then we've got stories that are reports that are looking at different issues related to the health of foster kids.
Well, Damon Bradford's a SUNY Brockport senior. How's it going there?
At Brockport?
At Brockport.
It's well.
It's going well?
Yeah, ready to graduate.
Ready to be done?
Yes, sir.
You got plans post-graduation?
Post-graduation, I'm not sure exactly what I want to do. I just realized last year that I didn't want to be in accounting anymore. So
that's what you were studying?
Business and accounting, yeah.
It's better to know that now than 5 or 10 years from now, I suppose. So you're kind of refiguring out a career path?
Well,
it's okay. Yeah, you're all set there. You don't have to touch any of those buttons there. You can talk right in. Go ahead.
Well, I personally want to be in the marijuana industry when it becomes legal in New York, because of profits that have been seen in other parts of the country.
Like Colorado, Washington?
Correct.
Okay. So right now there's a medical marijuana industry. Your assumption seems to be we're moving in that direction.
Yes.
And, polls indicate a public acceptance of that. politics a little slower to come around on that. But you want to work in that field. Okay. And why don't you kind of take us back through your own upbringing, Damon, as much as you want to share with us. Tell us about your childhood.
Well, when I was maybe 5 or 6, I went into my first foster care due to my mom's illness. And I was in that foster care for maybe 2-3 weeks before I moved down south with a family member. And at that time, from then until third grade, I was in 10 different homes in 3 different states between family and foster homes. And when I was in third grade, I was placed in a foster home with my younger sister. And everything was going well for maybe about a year or so. And I got very sick. I had a sinus infection that spread to my brain. And I ended up needing a double brain operation. And I was in the hospital for maybe 2.5 weeks. And while I was in the hospital, the home I was in told the county that they weren't able to provide the care that I needed. So I was placed in another foster home with another foster family whom would come and see me while I was in the hospital just to get to know me. And after I left the hospital, I stayed with them for about 2.5 years before I returned home. And while I was home, I was pretty much being the man of the house, making sure my mom was taking her medicine, my sister was going to school. And in 7th grade, I guess, lacked. And my mom ended up getting sick again and going into the hospital. And because of the relationship that I was able to make with my prior foster parents, I was able to call them, and they came to my help. And I stayed with them for maybe 2-3 weeks until my mom got better. And when it was time for me to go home, I told my mom that she wasn't suitable to be my mother, and I wanted to live with my foster parents that I was with. And I stayed with them, and in 10-19-10, I was adopted out of foster care, my 11th grade year of school.
11th grade year. So I want to kind of go back to when you said you were 5 or 6 the first time, essentially leaving home and starting that period of your life of just sort of almost, it sounded like almost constant moving. Do you remember at all as a child what you were thinking about the constant moves and the uncertainty?
As a child, I wasn't really sure what was going on. Mm-hmm. To me, what was important was my sister and I had somewhere to put our head. That's what went through my mind the most.
Even as a young child, you were thinking that, and you talk about almost becoming the man of the house before you were a full-grown man. You had to grow up pretty quickly.
Yes, sir.
It sounds like. Now, you worried about having a place to put your head. What about food and eating? I mean, did that come with any stress or struggle?
Well, when I was in care or with my family members, food wasn't so much of an issue. But when I was with my mom, there was times where we would run out of food because there wasn't enough. She was on public assistance, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't get enough food stamps or something. And I personally wouldn't eat as much to let them eat. And that's really the only issues that we had with food.
Okay. Well, you know, we're going to be talking as we go throughout the hour about the impacts on kids and trauma and definition of trauma. I wonder now, Damon, I mean, that's for someone like you, is that something you think about? I mean, the word trauma, do you think of yourself as having experienced that?
Well, I mean, when I explain my story to someone on the outside, to them, it may seem to be trauma, but to me, it's life. It's all I know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm looking at just some of the numbers. Foster children experience PTSD at twice the rate of U.S. war veterans.
That's right. So I was looking at some of the stats, and there's a few different stats that talk about that, but definitely rivaling people who've been in the military and who've seen combat. And this is something that happens. Not only does it happen and you've got these rates, but it's happening at very, very young ages. And Amy, I just wonder, you know, you're giving the trauma-informed care. Well, what does that mean as far as
your health outcomes for the rest of your life if you're exposed to trauma at infancy or 2, 3, 4 years old.
Right. Well, you know, it's tough because it depends on the environment that these children come from and where they land, if they stay, if they go back into an environment that's exceptionally chaotic. The outcomes are going to be a little bit different, but what we do find is that these children who are in these stable, structured homes, their outcomes are really great. They're wonderful. And we're even finding that even into adolescence, that these children who've been exposed to trauma, we can change those pathways in the brain, we can heal. And that's so amazing to hear and see because, you know, as a medical professional, I want to see that concrete evidence mm-hmm. that what we're doing is making a difference. And we're really finally starting to see that.
Now, in Damon, in your case, I think you mentioned 10-19-10. Was that the date?
Yes, sir.
That was the date that that you were adopted by, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And has it been, for lack of a better term, stable for you since then in terms of family, knowing where home is? I mean, now I know you've been going to SUNY Brockport, but is it more stable since 10-19-10?
Well, sort of. As long as I've been with Steve and Nicole, they were my foster parents, my adoptive parents now. As long as I've been with them, my life has been pretty stable. They make sure to keep structure
sure.
and keep me moving. And now that I'm in school and it's hard, I have them there to back me through the entire thing.
Before I turn it over to Liz for her story, I just want to ask you, Damon, you know, I'm really struck by how you describe at a young age thinking about your sister, thinking about finding a place to sleep, making sure you're taken care of, almost becoming the man of the house at a very young age. So you have a bit of an old soul about you when you think about trying to care for yourself and for other people around you. But you also say that, you know, you don't think of it as trauma, you just think of that as life. That's what your life has been. When you think about other kids in foster care now, when you think about a young kid who's maybe starting to go through what you did with a lot of moves, a lot of family uncertainty, you know, are you worried about what happens with them? I mean, do you think about that at all?
I do. I actually expressed to my parents a lot that the foster care system has helped me out, and because it's helped me out in the way that it has, I feel that it's my duty to try and help out with other kids going through similar situations.
Well, it's certainly admirable. I want to talk to Liz Kuykendall, who is now an administrative assistant at Steelwork in Rochester. How's it going for you there?
It's good. Yeah? I enjoy it.
Yeah, very good. Well, why don't you take us back as much as you want to share about your own childhood and your story, Liz?
All right. Well, I wasn't in foster care as long mm-hmm. as DJ. When I was 11, my mom had a mental breakdown and was unable to care for me and my brother. Before that, she was a little not stable as well. And like DJ, I kind of had to step up as the older sibling and, you know, make sure that my brother went to bed on time for school because my mom would often go to bed early just because she was very tired and she had a pretty traumatic life herself. So it was nothing she could control without help. And she was getting as much help as she could. And so in the summer of 2001, she kind of hit her breaking point where she felt like life was not worth living and that she didn't really want me and my brother to live this life anymore either, and was going to take further action. But in the midst of her breakdown, she did call her therapist and got the appropriate help. And unfortunately, we were taken away from her and placed in foster care. And the plan was is we were going to be in foster care until my dad was able to move up here and provide for us because he lived in Florida. I was placed with Sister Jean for 3 months and great environment. She's an awesome person, was always there for us. And then my dad moved up. And I moved out with him in Dispenserport with my brother. And he has never been a fan of Rochester, so he didn't do quite well up here and ended up wanting to go back to Florida. And, excuse me, they gave me and my brother the option to either stay here and be placed in foster care again or to go back with my dad to Florida. And I always had this very strong emotional attachment to my mom where I never wanted to move to Florida and be that far away from her, because she, I knew she wasn't well and she needed some support. So I chose to stay here, and that's when I was also placed with Nicole and Steve, who Damon lived with. And I lived with them for about a half a year to like 8 months, and it was awesome. I enjoyed every minute of it. It almost didn't feel like being in foster care, just because they accepted me into their family like I was one of their own. And, you know, it was a struggle for me because I only had my younger brother at home, and they had three younger children at the time, two girls and a boy. And the girls were always all over me, which was something I wasn't used to. So I struggled a little bit, but I eventually, you know, got into the groove of things. And we often joke that I would complain about how they did everything as a family together, because, again, my mom was not really on point with some of that stuff. So we didn't do a whole ton of, you know, family things. So, but I went to visit my father once while I was living with Nicole and Steve for that 6 months. And she always laughs because I came home and I was like, my God, they don't do anything together. We do nothing as a family. So, you know, I often look back and I'm like, raising my own daughter now, I'm like, that's a huge part of things, is to get up and go do things, which I may have not have realized just living with my family if I hadn't lived with Nicole and Steve. And to, you know, after 6 months, my mom worked really hard to get us back, and she was never fully, completely 100% well, but she did the best she could, and she was a great mom for what she could do. And but I always kept in contact with Nicole and Steve, and actually just had my daughter's third birthday at their house yesterday. So I'm very grateful that I was able to get that opportunity. I never look at it as being a bad situation. Whenever I talk to anybody, I always explain all the good things. There weren't really many bad things other than me being a kid and being in foster care and not really understanding what was happening.
Sure. And I'll ask you what I asked Damon, which is, do you think of yourself as having gone through trauma?
Other than what happened with my mother, no. Nothing when I was in foster care at all. I never look at that as being trauma. What my mom and us went through, yeah, that was trauma.
It's interesting. I'm curious to know what Amy thinks, listening to them tell their stories and then have to evaluate, have I gone through trauma? You know, I mean, it's I so admire, you know, the way they have this sense of perspective that I couldn't possibly have from my own life experience. It's really amazing. But what do you think when you hear them talk about trauma?
To sit here and listen to their stories, they're just so resilient, and that is what I see every day. Our kids that we see day in and day out, the resiliency is just amazing. And I think sometimes it's a protective mechanism. They don't want to think that they've gone through that trauma. But seeing them every day and seeing the symptoms that they present to me with, I know otherwise. But at the end of the day, I'm treating the symptoms. I'm helping them through, and however they want to view it, if they want to view it as trauma, if they want to view it as just, you know, a bad couple of months or a bad couple of years, that's fine with me. But I'm there to help them.
And the reason why it's really important to have someone who's kind of looking out in that way is, you know, we have the study that came out in the late 90s, the Adverse Childhood Experiences, or ACE study. And that just, what they did was they talked to many people and they had a score, and they just said, has this ever traumatic incident ever happened to you? Many of those things are the kind of things that happened in your childhood that would get you into the foster system or would happen to you while you're in the foster system. The higher your score is on that ACEs study, the more likely you are to have issues with high blood pressure, heart disease, and just a number of poor health outcomes. And we're talking about people well into their older age. So these things that happen to you at an early age, they can have consequences physically much later in life.
Well, let's do this. Let's get a short break, and we'll come back and continue the conversation. Michelle Faust, a WXXI reporter, helping lead this conversation. It's an extended conversation based on the Fragile Life series that we're presenting this month. Michelle's work looking at kids in the foster care system and the impact of trauma and ways that we can, I think, you know, make the system even more effective in helping kids. So we'll talk about that when we come back. And by the way, your daughter, you said, is three?
Three today. Yeah, it's her birthday today.
Congratulations. That's it's an amazing age. No, that's wonderful.
Thank you.
So you're hearing Liz and Damon tell their stories, and Amy Real-Buto as well, a nurse practitioner at Starlight Pediatric. The conversation continues in a moment. Coming up in our second hour, we take a look at democratic socialism. Bernie Sanders was in Rochester today, huge rally. And he, of course, is a democratic socialist running as a Democrat for the White House. His supporters say it is time for a revolution of democratic socialism. His opponents from the Clinton campaign say it's not practical. So what is democratic socialism after all? Let's have a conversation next hour.
When teachers get training, it's not so hard to recognize gifted students.
They're quirky. They are a little bit argumentative, and they keep you on your toes, and they don't let you get away with anything.
But sometimes those things are harder to see in students still learning English. What some schools are doing to identify all gifted students, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, talking about foster care this hour. And I would be remiss if I didn't say that if you want to call the program, you can do that, either sharing your experiences or if you've got any questions. It's 844-295-TALK, toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. But the hour is going quick. And Michelle Faust, you know, one of the things that I wanted to make sure we talk about, and I'm happy to just really follow your lead here, is how you... either how you heal trauma or how you, you know, how we improve foster care even more to the point where, you know, we're never going to not have a need for it. I mean, that's just not how life is going to work. But how can we create a society where kids who end up in the foster care system have even better outcomes and, you know, we're sort of vigilant about possible adverse health effects? You mentioned all the things that you would think are obvious are there. But then there's also heart disease and all these other things that we might not think are obvious on the surface that come later. So how do we start improving that?
Well, you know, I'm definitely not the expert to make that to make that assessment, but I would say that I've spoken to several people who are on the lookout for that. There's a lot of research going on to what can you do. I mean, that's the whole point of the ACEs study, just kind of points to here's some causes of some issues that can affect you throughout your life, but the idea is to keep tabs on that and see what can be done. I recently took a vacation, and because I never take a vacation, I went ahead and spoke with a woman actually who did the start of her work actually was at Starlight. That's Moira Salaji, and she is the chair of a committee for the American Academy of Pediatrics that deals with foster care. And when I was in LA, instead of, you know, hanging out on the beach in Malibu, I went and hung out with her and interviewed her. And one thing that she said that really struck me was that foster parents, and it was really the love that you get in a family and someone having your back and making sure that you're getting to school, making sure that you're getting to the doctor appointment, getting to, if it's Starlight, or going to go get a specialist care that you wouldn't necessarily have had elsewhere. She was saying that's really what heals this trauma. That's what she was saying. This is our treatment, and it's foster parents, the good foster parents, because since we've released the story, I've had some people who said, you know, I did not have a good experience in foster care. And we have to acknowledge that it's not always a good experience. Sure. But a good foster family that's actually providing that love, based on all the people I've spoken to, that goes such a long way.
Amy, what do you think about that?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that's why having a place like Starlight is so important, because we have such a great relationship with our foster parents. We're working collaboratively with them. We're working collaboratively with the biological parents. And over the years, I have seen a lot of relationships made and the best outcomes, whether a child goes on to be adopted or returned home to the biological family, is when a foster parent and a biological parent just really, you know, create such a great relationship and are very communicative and are able to express the concerns back and forth. I think that is where the children really feel the support. And like I said, it could, you know, the child could go on, you know, to be adopted by the foster parent, and they still have connections with those biological parents. And, you know, it's just so great to see some of the relationships that are made. So, you know, just being part of that, that team approach with these children, I think is just provides great outcomes.
Well, let me ask David and Damon and Liz. Liz to kind of weigh in on that. For you, you know, Liz, you mentioned there was a point in your life where you understood when your mother was having struggles that you were going to have to help with a sibling, maybe just getting ready for school and getting in bed and kind of going through that process. When you felt a little more stability, when you had someone kind of having your back, as in Michelle's words there, you know, I saw you nodding at that moment. What's the impact on someone in foster care when you finally feel that sense of stability?
I mean, it just helps you thrive 100% better than you would without that stability. I feel like the biggest key to parenting, whether it's foster children or your own parent, excuse me, is structure and stability. It's just super important. And I hate to think that there's foster parents out there that don't do that, but we all know there are. And it's just, I'm so thankful that I was lucky enough to be with a family who was very structured, very, supportive of any in every way, shape, and form. It really makes a huge difference.
Damon, what do you think?
I agree. When I was home, there wasn't as much stability, and it was a lot of stress on me, as opposed to when I lived with Steve and Nicole, and instead of me making sure everything is getting done, they're making sure I'm getting everything done that I need to do. They're waking me up to go to school, which helps. When I was not with them, I was attending East High in seventh grade, and I went maybe 2 weeks the entire time. And after I went back to live with them, I switched to Wheatland, and that's when I had the most stability, and that is when I started to thrive the most.
And play sports.
And play sports.
Sure. Well, we've got a question from a caller named Philip who's on the line with us, and I think the question is for Damon and Liz. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, I was just wondering, how hard was it for you guys to make friends when you were going through foster care?
Well, for me personally, it was hard to make friends whether I was in foster care or out of foster care, but I actually made more friends in the neighborhood that I lived in with my foster parents than I did at home. And I started going to a new school and thrived a whole ton there as well, because my foster mom was really great at teaching me how to, like, talk to people, make new friends, do my hair, make sure I looked more like every other kid did versus, you know, just doing whatever I thought was right. And, so that helped me quite a bit.
Damon?
Well, making friends itself isn't hard. However, letting your friends know about you, what you feel comfortable with, is the hard part. It wasn't hard for me to make friends, but allowing people to know what I've been through and what I've lived and witnessed was the hard part.
Okay.
So, how do I put it? I don't know.
No, I mean, I think that's a profound point right there. Philip, you want to follow up?
No, I just wanted to ask how hard it was and say, A.O., good job, DJ.
Thanks, Phil.
Well, I want to get one more question from a listener. I got an email from a listener named David who just said, my wife and I had thought about becoming foster parents. What is the vetting process like? I don't know. Amy, can you answer that?
Yeah. Monroe County is always offering informational meetings regarding foster parenting, and you can go right onto their Facebook website or the Monroe County website. But once you have chosen to take that path, typically there will be background checks prior to the training even happening, and then it's an 11-week training process that happens. It's once a week for 3 hours for 10 weeks, and then there is an 11th meeting that typically happens within a year after. But it doesn't mean that you can't start taking foster children, but it is 11 weeks total.
In his email, he was also curious about how, I think he's essentially saying, how often do foster parents end up adopting, and is that the goal?
No. When a child enters foster care, goal is always reunification with the parent.
Reunification, yeah.
Always okay. Reunification. As far as adoption goes, I'm not sure. I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I can't exactly speak to
sure.
those specific numbers.
But as we've been talking about it throughout this series, is the goal is to have a permanent plan for a child, whether that is to go home or to stay with a permanent home, an adoptive home. So that's something that happens. So it's a matter of just kind of trying to figure that out. But the majority of kids do end up going home to their parents. What that happens is they'll get the training that they need to improve whatever the issue is. Do they need more help with food? Do they need other assistance? And get them the assistance, get them trained, and hopefully they'll be able to take their own kids back. And that doesn't necessarily always happen, but it's the goal.
I have a question for Michelle.
Sure.
So with all the studies, is there any numbers that you have where a child will go home and then will end up back into care?
A lot of kids are coming back into care. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but if you want me to look at those specific numbers, I'm happy to go over them because I've got studies and studies on my desk right now. But a lot of kids are going in and out of care. And that is the whole idea of having a permanent plan, because it's not healthy for kids to be going in, go home, go back, go home, go back. That in itself can cause some trauma.
Go ahead, Amy.
Absolutely. I agree. And that is part of our role too at Starlight, is to help with that transition process, to be sure that when this child is transitioning home, that these parents are ready. We have parents who come into the clinic. We do a lot of teaching with parents, and we prepare both the child, we prepare the foster parent and the biological parent, because we don't want to set a parent up for failure. We want to see this be successful. If that is the goal, that's what we want to see, and we want to be successful in it.
All right, emailer David, if you want more information, again, contact Monroe County. What's the agency?
It would be the Monroe County Facebook. Home Finding is who you would contact regarding foster parent training.
All right, David, thanks for the email and good luck. I know Michelle Faust has done some reporting and telling other stories as well. And I want to present some of those we can get a chance to hear.
That's right. Now. You know, and just to say to anyone who is thinking about foster care, everyone that I've interviewed throughout this process has tried to recruit me to take the MAP training. And what has been advised to me is go ahead and take the MAP training, go ahead and call the county, see what you need to do, take the course, and then if you need to, you know, make a change, if you realize that you're not quite up to the challenge, then you know. And it's been told to me over and over and over again in Monroe County, as well as every other county in the country, there's definitely a need for older kids, especially teenagers don't necessarily have a place to go. And it's such a critical time in a child's life.
So what are we going to listen to now?
So right now we're going to be talking about a project that's called Foster Stories. And what happened was, as I was reaching out to foster care alumni, they are helping a project that is telling stories of people who've been in the foster system. I spoke with Steve Rideout, and he's a retired juvenile and domestic relations district court judge. He started doing that work in 1989. He's living in Maryland. He's working with a community radio station, WHCP, in Cambridge, Maryland, and they're airing some of these stories. They also have those online on SoundCloud, and we'll have a link to that on the website later. And he talks about why he, after being a judge, decided he wanted to work with foster kids.
When I was on the bench, I had a foster parent who was in court, and they were talking about trying to find an adoptive parent for the 8-year-old. And as I watched that family, foster father, foster mother, and the child were all sitting there with arms around one another, and there wasn't any mention of them as being the adoptive parent. And so I asked, you know, have you talked with them? Well, no, they hadn't. But it was, and the father got up and started talking about how important this child was to him and his wife. And so they wound up being able to adopt that child. So they're all of those kinds of stories. They're stories by judges of decisions that they made. For instance, I heard one story where a judge ordered the social worker to bring in to court all of the former foster parents of a child who was now a teenager who wanted to be adopted. And they couldn't find somebody, and so they brought in all the foster parents. None of them could adopt, but one stood up and said, well, the next door neighbor had a child who was, you know, Johnny's age, and they got along really great, and maybe they would be the one to adopt, and it turned out that they were. So it's those kinds of things that make this work not work. It's almost a mission.
To leave us on an optimistic note, what do you think is working?
Well, there are a number of things that are working well. Number one, lawyers are being better trained to represent children and parents in the system. Another is that the federal government supports court improvement programs in all 50 states where judges are trained and supported in their work to make the system work better. I was on a National Child Welfare Workforce Initiative advisory board. They're doing great work in training social workers, supervisors level about how to do this work better. And what I have seen over the years is a significant improvement in moving children through the system, getting them to permanency sooner. One of the things that we did in Alexandria, where I was on the bench, was we developed a family treatment drug court, one of the first in the country that either helped get parents sober in recovery and children back to them, or were able to show that the parents were not interested in that, and we were able to move those children to permanency sooner. So there's lots of good work being done out there. It's still a system that has its challenges, those are individual challenges or challenges in a particular community, but the system itself is doing, I think, a better job over time in trying to help children. But that doesn't mean they can't do better, because they can.
So in talking with Steve Rideout, and he talked about how he really thinks that judges can be part of that movement towards improving things that are not necessarily working right in the system. Then he connected me with Chris Chmielewski. And Chris is a former board member for the NCAA, which is the Foster Care Alumni of America. And he publishes and edits and writes, and he runs this magazine called Foster Focus. He talked to me about something that's really important. He wants to adopt 18, 19, 20-year-olds, because what happens? People think, oh, you're 18, you're 21, you're an adult. But what happens then? Just think about yourself, Evan. How many times did you go back and talk to your dad? I know that you've told me that you go and talk to your dad after, you know, now as a grown man with your own kid.
He's probably listening to this program. Yeah.
Yeah, so you go and you get that advice for, you know, very practical things and for emotional support as well. And things like, how do I rent, buy a house? You know, things that you wouldn't necessarily know or have learned. And Chris was talking about how he experienced homelessness. It's a large number of the homeless population in this country were in foster care at some point, so we can hear his story.
Overall, they just spoke to me like a person, and when you're going through the system, when you first come in, there's a lot of sitting, there's a lot of waiting, there's a lot of talking to people who are disinterested in your situation, and you rarely get asked anything, let alone your opinion or how you feel, and so When I sat down at the table for the first time, and someone asked me that question and spoke to me like a person, it took a lot of the tension out of the situation.
When you say spoke to you like you were a person, I'm trying to figure out what was the other interactions that you were having that didn't feel like you were being talked to like a person. People were talking around you about you.
Yeah, there's a lot of sitting next to the desk of your caseworker and having them discuss your life. There's a lot of, hey, come here, you over here, you get in the car, come on, we're going. You rarely get called your name. Everybody's in a hurry because this stuff has to happen at a kind of a frantic pace to lessen the trauma of it all.
Yeah. So you said that your early adulthood was quite difficult, and you mentioned that there was some moments of homelessness. Can you kind of tell me how that went?
Well, sure. When I first aged out, unfortunately, it was by choice, which is not what happens to a lot of kids. A lot of kids are told it's time for you to leave. What happened with me was I had gone past the age at the time of 18. I had signed the waiver, and I continued to be in care. I found out that my foster parents were the ones paying for everything. The state was putting in no money because I was no longer their responsibility. I felt like a burden, so I left on my own. And in that first 2-3 months, I was homeless. I was living kind of a squatter's life in a house. And eventually one of my friend's moms would make me stay with them until college began, and I aged out and was subsequently expelled from school without the ability to verify an address in the school district. So the mom who took me in, my friend's mom helped me get my GED, enrolled me in college, and got me an apartment. I stayed in college for a little while. Didn't take. College isn't for everyone, and I wanted to work. And I ended up homeless for a little bit again, and then I ended up living above a kennel, a dog mill that I worked for. And then fortunately met my wife, and then things started to work out the way they were supposed to. But it was a sticky situation for a couple of years there.
So Chris, now he's doing really well. He's got kids of his own. He runs his Foster Focus magazine. His kids, because we were talking about some of the health outcomes, something as simple as teaching your kid to brush their teeth, you think would be something that would be just normal, but it isn't necessarily for everyone. I was actually sent the story of Marissa Myers, and she has some pretty bad tooth decay that started from when she was a very young child. We had to cut down the story because it was a little bit long, but she tells us the story about how she to this day is still spending money, and every time she goes to the doctor, spending thousands and thousands of dollars because of problems with her teeth.
This was one of my only positive memories from the first time I was placed in a group home. I was just 9 years old, and I didn't have a clue as to why no one ever gave me a toothbrush and told me how important it was to brush my teeth. It is one of the hardest lessons I've ever had to teach myself. After 18 fillings, 3 teeth pulled, 5 root canals, gum disease, and gum scaling, I finally had caught up after so many years of not going to the dentist. The total on this work is estimated to be somewhere around $13,000 out of my pocket, and another $10,000 covered by my dental plan with Penn. I'll remind you that absolutely none of this work was cosmetic, but solely to keep my teeth. What 26-year-old doesn't want to keep her teeth? I'm not sure what was worse, the physical pain or the money I was spending. I not only hated my mother for this, but I hated the system for letting me down. It just seemed like taking care of my teeth was one of the easiest tasks for a parent. It essentially came with directions. You might think the story is ending well because my teeth are healthy. I just finished paying off the last installment of my dental bills this month. And I fully understand the need to brush and schedule dentist appointments regularly. But here's where you're wrong. While I am a former foster youth, it never leaves me, similar to my dental issues. I will always need to have dental work done, and that will be a struggle I continue to face as a victim of the system until I'm old and gray. Abuse, drugs, and mental illness do not heavily impact my life anymore. But the experiences can sometimes come out to haunt me, just as they do when I go to the dentist. Fortunately, I'm what most would consider the epitome of a success story. However, I'm not really a big fan of that term. I'd rather just say, I'm a former foster youth trying to make a difference. And in making a difference, I'm also trying to understand, not only for myself, but also for every kid who has endured the pain associated with growing up in the system.
And I saw Damon, you were nodding when you kind of relate to what she said at the end there, huh?
Yes.
It's all right. You don't have to elaborate anymore. Damon and Liz have told their stories, and I want to thank them for being here for the hour. As we get ready to wrap up, Michelle Faust, let our listeners know again where they can find more of your work, more of these kind of stories as we understand the foster system.
That's right. It's at WXXINews.org. We've got a link right there on the corner, and it says Fragile Lives. You link on that, and you can get a... You can listen to this story, you can listen to stories from before, and we'll have links there as well to some of those other stories from the the Foster Care Alumni Association.
There you go. And just about a minute left here. Amy Real Buto, nurse practitioner at Starlight Pediatric. You know, the work that you do there and the way you see our foster system. This community is trying to tackle poverty. They're trying to tackle problems from a lot of different angles. What gives you the most optimism as we go forward?
I think what gives me the most optimism, as I said before, is just the relationships that we're making with just community partners, with getting the word out there that the needs of these children are very important and they're going to impact our future. There's so much more work to do, but it gives me hope that people are listening.
Thanks for the work you do, and thanks for taking the time to share your stories. And Liz and Damon, good luck to you guys. I know you got a lot of work to do in your own future. You got a 3-year-old at home. That's a lot of work every single day. But thank you. And thanks for sharing your stories, helping us understand the foster care system, and for joining the program today. Liz Kuykendall and Damon Bradford. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. Short break, and we've got much more connections. Michelle Faust, I should thank you, too.
Okay. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Michelle. Thanks for all the work here that she's been doing on the Fragile Lives. And again, WXXINews.org for that. Short break, much more connections is next.